I'm just an AI voice, but let me artificially intelligently tell you to get ready for an insightful journey into the creative mind that's shaping narratives and breaking barriers in advertising.
Introducing Yakima Moffitt, the Whedon plus Kennedy creative director and creative force.
One way that I judge if I feel like it's good is if my brain just turns on and all this stuff just starts happening and I just have to like jot down everything.
Yakima's vision for Visa's Everyone's Mountain transcended advertising. It became a narrative that championed inclusivity and ambition.
For the most part, I've noticed that my work is a lot better when I'm like sleeping.
An acclaimed creative director whose work not only resonates with audiences, but also garners industry-wide recognition. With a talent for crafting stories that resonate on a personal level, Yakima Moffitt stands at the forefront of advertising's evolution. Join Jason Bagley and Whedon plus Kennedy CD Yakima Moffitt on the latest episode of Bagley Talks to an Important Person as they explore the artistry and impact of her work in advertising.
It's Jason Bagley's advertising podcast. He interviews important people, it's true. But that doesn't mean that you're not important, 'cause he didn't choose to interview you. Maybe he was just planning to contact you to interview you on another day. Or maybe he doesn't have your email address. Every creature on the planet is important in their own special way. Cows, sharks, and gazelles deserve to be interviewed. Birds and whales each have a valid point of view. I mean, they're probably not as interesting to talk to as you, but you're less interesting than the person on that show. It's true, I'm not sure what my point is.
Yakima, welcome to Bagley Talks to an Important Person. We've been trying to get this on the books for a while. I appreciate you making the time.
This is Thank you for being okay with my schedule and needs to change things very last minute. I appreciate it. But I'm happy to be talking to you today.
No worries at all. I know what it's like to be a creative director at Whedon and Kennedy. I was thinking back, getting prepared for this, of Baldwin and I looking at your portfolio before you got hired at Whedon and Kennedy, and immediately being like, okay, we like this girl. She has a very clear voice. There was a personality coming through in the work, and that's a rare thing. And that's really, I think more than anything, that's what we look for at Whedon and Kennedy. We're looking for a unique and distinct voice, somebody that has sort of found, at least has begun to find their creative voice and has the courage to kind of express it in the work. And that's definitely what we saw.
I appreciate you saying that, first of all. Whedon was like on my list from the beginning. I sent this really embarrassing email a long time ago that was like, oh, do you have any jobs for me? And I'd never heard anything back, but they like kept it and showed it to me later. And I was like, oops. But no, it's been awesome. It's been really cool to be in a space where I feel like I can, you know, come with all these different ideas and there's like a home for them. So, yeah.
So how does that feel? Because Whedon was definitely like the top of my list before I got to Whedon. And I was certainly trying to, as Oprah would say, manifest Whedon and Kennedy into my life. But when it finally happened, it was so surreal. I was so intimidated and blown away and pretty much felt positive that they would discover me as a fraud in the first 30 days and kick me out the back door. But how was that? How has that been for you?
You know what? I feel like I got kind of lucky in the fact that I didn't get to go immediately. I got to go into a bunch of different other agencies. I like bounced back and forth across the country, just trying different places, and even went like client side once. And I think having had more experiences before I got there helped me be slightly less freaked out by it. But I don't know, like when it finally happened, I was just like, yes, I'm finally here. Oh no, now I have to make something that's really good. And I'm so nervous. And that, you know, that can be terrifying, but it can also be really motivating and kind of push you out of your comfort zone to you know, bring some stuff to the table that you may not have otherwise. So I don't think it was a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You probably came in with a little more confidence than I did, because you had a bit more experience. That makes sense. So I was looking at your website, and under your little protagonist bio section, it says, "In a small town where everyone knows what you had for breakfast last Thursday, a very old but charming preacher and his worldly young secretary had encounters that you and I should avoid thinking about at all costs. Instead, consider what this scenario has to do with writing. When you grow up a taboo, nothing feels more interesting than the truth." So you got my curiosity up. What, let's talk about this origin story.
Yeah.
Preacher, so my secretary.
Yeah. When I was conceived, I believe my dad was like 72 and my mom was like roughly 32. So big age difference, but he was this like charming older guy who like wore nice suits and he had this like beautiful laugh. And yeah, I don't know. He probably had a penchant for younger women. And my mom worked at the church. That was his church. And like, yeah, I don't know. One thing led to another. And here I am. So that it made for a very interesting upbringing, because they never got married or anything. But they always like had a relationship until he, you know, passed away. Yeah, it was weird. And I remember it like not thinking it was weird. And then I talked to other people and I'd go, wait a second, this is kind of different. this is not the usual way that kids happen, is it?
Okay. So did he continue being the preacher, and did the congregation not have an issue?
No, we still went to the church and everything. And so on weekends, that's where I was. And that was usually when I saw him. Like sometimes we'd also go visit during the week. But he was like my dad, the guy who's at the church, who's very old. Yeah, it was a trip.
And everybody knew about it, and the congregation was cool.
We still went. You might have to ask my mom about the nuances and particulars. I know there's maybe a little bit of weirdness with the children who already existed, who were like older than my mother. But you know, things work themselves out.
Well, that is a fascinating origin story. Thanks for sharing that. What I would love to do, and what I know people would love to hear, is kind of let's talk a little bit about your creative process. You know, you've made a lot of great work, and before, you know, it's one of the things that in the industry, one of the reasons I did this podcast is we don't hear a lot of details about great creatives and exactly how they do what they do. It's kind of this black box of mystery. And so what I'm trying to do here is kind of reveal and get into the details of different creatives who have done great work and how they do it.
Yeah, it's not always the same. So this assignment of like trying to put down mine to paper, it was honestly kind of hard. I was just like, well, yeah, I did this time and this time. So instead of how I do every single step, I decided it would just be a collection of tips and tricks and things that I've found useful in me trying to get to an idea. And I don't always do these on every single project, but I've noticed that these are things that come back often.
Yeah. So. Are you an advertising creative or creative director, and despite all your hard work, you're still not making the kind of creative you want? Well, I know what it's like to be frustrated that you aren't getting better creative opportunities, feeling like you're falling behind your peers and not getting the support you need. Using a specific 7-step process, my teams and I have been able to win major advertising awards every year for 20 consecutive years. If you would like to learn the exact same 7-step process my teams and I use to create iconic campaigns for Old Spice, Nike, KFC, and others, and how you can start doing the best work of your life in less than 60 days, click the link somewhere on or around this video, and it'll take you to a page where you can register for a completely free online training I put together for any creatives wanting to do the best work of their life. So go ahead, click the link on or around this video and register for the free training, and I'll see you there.
Originally, when you reached out, I was like, oh, it would be so cute if I, like, you know, took an airline safety pamphlet vibe and applied that to this and everything. But I don't really have the greatest visual skills, and I have a job, and there's two little kids who live in my house now. So here we are, very simple black slides with some text on them, and it'll do. All right, so a thing that helps. The first one here is be a random black girl from Southwest Michigan or whatever you are. I think it is so, so important to, like, be yourself and acknowledge the experiences that you've had and acknowledge your point of view on the world and how that's different from other people, because I think that that's a huge part of where my inspiration comes from. I think it's a huge part of how my perspectives have formulated, like, you know, being a small town person sort of made life different from me. Being a small town person in a space that I didn't consider very diverse made me approach everything differently. And to just try to mine into that a little bit more, like, I feel like the next slide literally says boredom. Being in a small town that wasn't very diverse kind of forced me to try and find things that were interesting. Like, we had a Walmart, we had a bowling alley, there's like a little park by the river, we had a library, and I spent like a ton of time at the library because I was like, okay, like, this is kind of a respite for me. I can just go into the stacks and, like, find experiences that look nothing like mine. I can find ones that look, you know, pretty similar to mine. And so I ended up being a person who just tried to dig into escapism a lot just to try to keep myself entertained. I actually have, hold on. So being the random black girl from Southwest Michigan, this is something I got in high school. I don't know why I've kept it, but it says citizenship award. And to this day, I have no idea what it means. I got it in high school, and I think it was very representative of my time there, where I was like this kid who, like, had pretty average grades unless it was math, which meant that they were bad. I was, you know, good at English, stayed out of trouble, yeah, played a couple of sports, you know, did the school paper, and but, like, I never felt like the standout kid in this award to me. It just felt like they're like, well, she's okay.
She's a good citizen.
She's a great citizen. Kind of made me want to go, like, egg a house or something. I was just like, oh, what am I doing? But yeah, it just.
Little did they know that giving you the Good Citizen Award would make you want to be a rebel.
I don't know that I ever actually became one, but yeah, I don't know. It's a. It made me have to approach life a little bit differently and think about things differently. And I think
are you even aware? Because I think about this sometimes, that I talk a lot in my program, and I think it really comes from Dan and everything that Dan stood for, about just he really loved finding unique people with unique backgrounds that had a unique. That could express their background and their whatever made them the way they are, they could express it in a unique way, and that was his kind of secret sauce, was finding those different types of people. And he was collecting them. He was literally collecting. He wanted to find people that had sort of different experiences than his own, and then other people in the agency. And I certainly think I fall into that category. You know, I felt very different from anyone else at Wyden at the time that I was hired. And I don't necessarily know how that, I don't know if I even know how, all the ways that affected my work. But I could, some of them, like for you, you're like, okay, I was bored. Maybe you felt a little bit out of place. So that led you to the library where you read books, and you know that much. But Is it a conscious thing that you try to kind of pull that out? Or is it just, for me, I just think it's who I am. Like I just, it's more about having the courage to like what I like and to bring that to the work than to necessarily analyze my past and be like, well, I gotta bring this to the forefront. It's just like, be who you are. Is that what you would say?
I don't think it was something that I knew the value of right away. Like, I remember even writing that, like, the about me section, like years ago, and like, okay, what do people need to know? But like, what do I need to say to the world for people to kind of get an idea of who I am? And it took a long time for me to figure out what to actually say. And I don't think it's something where you always will know how it's actually impacting the work. It's just you're being yourself. And I think the more that you're comfortable just being whatever you are and being into what you're into and being like able to just open up to people and kind of allow yourself to be vulnerable, the more that that's going to be clear to other people, but it might not always be obvious to you, I don't think.
Yeah.
I can say this stuff now though, like being like over a decade into the industry, and I think now I have a little bit more of a clear idea of how things came together, but not at the beginning.
Yeah. I think there's probably a lot of people out there listening to this that are like, well, I'm not unique at all. I don't have anything interesting. And they feel they're afraid that they don't have any experience or anything unique. They, you know, maybe they grew up just, in their opinion, in the most normal manner. And I always tell them, you do. Everybody has, you may not know what it is yet. You may not be aware of it, and you don't necessarily need to be. You just have to learn to trust yourself and to lean into the things that you love and the things that inspire you. And those things are shaped by your background. They're shaped by your personality and all those things. And most people think they're not interesting. Most people think they're boring or they don't have that interesting of a background. And so that's that. It doesn't mean it's true.
And also, even if you are an extremely boring person, I'll just say this, it doesn't mean your work is. Okay, love stuff. So if you click again, it explodes. I think a huge thing that is so central to the way that I do work, the way that I approach it all, is just loving things from music to books. Like, I can literally tell when I'm not reading enough because the writing would always suffer. Film, things about history that just kind of make me feel chuffed. Subculture, mangoes, fashion, museums, anything that just sort of gets your brain excited and, you know, hype about something. I think even if you don't know how that stuff is going to impact the work, it does come back to do something where you're like, this is a thing that entertained me, and like, how am I going to go forward and entertain with that? Not that you like literally bite from the things that you're using for input, but you definitely benefit when you are someone who's consuming things that interest you. So
you're saying part of this is like, make sure you're consuming, and then, and particularly make sure you're trying to consume stuff that you love, that excites you, that gets you inspired. And I sometimes say, it takes a lot more courage to love something than to hate it. If you hate everything, then you get to be the cool, invulnerable. You're never really putting yourself out there. You're like, oh, I hate everything. That means I have such amazing taste that I just don't like anything. It's a much more vulnerable act to say like, oh, I love that. I love that album, or I love that. And I think the person, the creative that can develop that courage to just be vulnerable and embrace the things they love, regardless of what other people think, that person is going to have the interesting work.
Love more stuff that's not on the internet.
Oh, not on the internet. Yeah.
Like, I feel like we spend so much time on it. We look at screens all day, and I could be wrong here, but I do kind of feel like this thing can happen where everyone's interests and references start to like congeal and become one thing. And I think the more you can like diversify the spaces that you're getting your input from, the better, because it's not going to all feel like same, same. Okay, so when you actually get to the bit where you're being briefed, this is something that I'll do. It's not always fruitful, but literally during the brief, one way that I judge if I feel like it's good is if my brain just turns on and all this stuff just starts happening and I just have to like jot down everything. And sometimes that stuff gets used, sometimes it doesn't, but I do find it very useful to like be able to come back to those first thoughts. And I know people sometimes say like the first idea is never the idea, but sometimes there's something in it that could inform, you know, what happens down the line.
Yeah, totally.
I think that helps. Poop, vomit, in other words, that mean just get it out of you. I won't say I got in trouble, but I will say I've had reviews where people basically told me like, yo, you need to edit your stuff down a little bit and, you know, not bring as much, like start considering what stuff you really, really like. And I think that is true. Once you do get a little more experience, that does, you know, become a useful thing to be able to like edit yourself. But at the beginning, especially, you gotta just let it out. Even after you've been in it for 20 years, I still think you got, if it's a dumb thought and it's in you, you just have to get it out.
Yeah.
'Cause once it's out, you can move past it and on to like more. But yeah, that's a huge part of my process. I like have documents and notebooks and things that just are full of junk.
And I think that's why you've been successful, is that I beat this, you know, beat this drum constantly, but the most consistent trait that I have seen of highly successful creatives is that they are prolific, that they generate a lot of ideas. And that means, and then that means most of those ideas are going to be terrible, but they just generate a ton of ideas. And, you got to just get it out. You got to find ways to just get all those bad ideas down on paper and let them go.
The next thing for me that helps is to marinate like a good meat or a meat substitute for people who don't eat meat. Also, sorry for putting poop and food metaphors so close to each other. I think this part is probably one of the more frustrating ones because it doesn't feel like anything is happening, but I do feel like you have to sometimes just step away and do something else and just let your brain, which is not going to turn off, like keep working on the problem in the background and then come back to it later. But I don't know that you can just lay into a problem and not give yourself any space for, you know, it's like a wine. They claim that, you know, if there's air on it, it tastes better or something, or the notes come out a little bit better. And I think that's true for ideas too.
Yeah. Our subconscious mind is often more interesting than our conscious mind. So we got to let the subconscious mind work on it for a while.
Yeah. The next thing is more pooping, but with a partner. I do, in my process, usually like to start off alone because I don't want like outside stuff influencing where my head wants to go at the beginning. But then I want to come back together with a partner and sit there and shoot stuff back and forth and go like, okay, well, what do you have? Okay, this is what I have. And we just kind of sit there and build upon each other's ideas or go like, you know what, you have this pretty low on here, but I really like it. And I think this could be better if you did X, Y, Z. And sometimes it's, you know, telling them like, I don't like this. Which actually leads me to the next slide, which is not always saying no, but sometimes just going, I don't know. Because there have been times when a partner has brought something to the table that I wasn't as excited about because I just couldn't see it, or vice versa, where I've brought something to the table that I was really confident about and really excited about, and they just couldn't come around. And I think a lot of the time, especially when an idea is young, you have to, you know, give it some room, give it some time, because there might be something there that you're not actually seeing.
Yeah. And there's a delicate dance between partners too, right? Where you want to reserve the word no for very rare occasions. And, you know, sometimes if I'm concepting with a partner and they throw out an idea that just doesn't spark anything for me or doesn't seem like a very good idea, instead of being like, oh, that, yeah, no, that's not a good idea, just be like, what if, and then just throw out an idea that has nothing to do with the idea. And you're not tricking your partner. They know what's happening, but there's just a flow that happens. Like you want to have it be a very positive environment where there's very little kind of stoppage, very little like, no, that sucks. Just sort of jump on to the next idea.
Oh, so I'm not the most visual person in the world, but a thing I like to do is to look at photography. Like I'm a big fan of, honestly, like last night when I was preparing for this, I like pulled out a couple of stacks of like books that I just like. And I noticed a theme is I think I'm just obsessed with people. And with the photography that I look at, usually the stuff that I'm most drawn toward is like people. And it's like, they're very candid and it kind of feels unposed and almost like composed journalism, I guess. So like people like Daniel Arnold and like Gordon Parks, like it just, where you're just kind of showing what's there and finding the poetry and just humanity, because there's so much and there's so much that's interesting. And I think that goes back to me being a kid from a small town where like I literally couldn't go anywhere and be anonymous because it was so tiny, and my family was like one of the bigger Black families in town, and so it just, everyone knew who you were, and so it kind of made me just drawn to otherness and other places and other people. And so like all photography, like I'm,
oh yeah,
one I love, this one is like this dude like took photos of people in the same place over the course of like,
who is that,
about like, his name is Peter Funch, and the book is called 42nd and Vanderbilt. And it like, he just kept photographing like the same people kind of doing the same poses on their commutes. It just, I don't know. I was so tickled by this. There's so much that's just interesting to look at, and you can find beauty and humor in just life, you know?
Yeah.
So the next thing that I think helps a lot is just going to bed. I'm sorry. Like, I remember being a young creative and I keep my notebooks. Like, I need to actually stop doing that, but I keep my notebooks. And I could always kind of tell when I was really exhausted because the ideas were not, they're not good for me personally. So I needed rest. I needed my brain to actually be functioning. And so while, you know, there were nights that I had to stay up later and, you know, spend a little bit more time in the office than intended, but for the most part, I've noticed that my work is a lot better when I'm like sleeping. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, 100%. I look back and I think, man, I was so stupid for so many years and just would grinding it out until 1 or 2 in the morning. And if I look back, and of course there's days where you have to do that. You got to pitch the next day or whatever. You don't have a choice. But for the most part, when I look back, my productivity just absolutely fell off a cliff after, you know, a certain point in time where I would have been just so much better off just going home and going to sleep.
Getting up early.
Yeah. And hit it the next day.
Agreed. And I don't know why that like culturally seems to stick with people so long, but it doesn't work. Just if you're a person who does it all the time, I would implore you, just try to sleep and see if things get better. I think they will.
I think we're getting we're getting a little bit better as an industry.
I hope so. I do feel like there's been a shift. I hope there's been a shift, but I also am only working at one place right now, so I don't know. Get in a fight with common sense. I think one practice I like to try after a brief is just like just dig into what the actual problem is and go like, okay, what if we just said the opposite? Like, is there something that people believe today that maybe we should try to disrupt? And it doesn't always work, but sometimes it leads to something interesting. The next thing is bothering somebody smart. And sometimes that is the people who literally wrote the brief. I feel like strategists are an insanely good resource to have, like, and they're always down, or at least, you know, good ones are always down to sit with you and just talk about, you know, where your head is and answer questions about how they got where they got to. And if I'm feeling like particularly stuck, this is something I'd love to do. Another thing that helps is talking to people who want me to be less responsible. This has been told to me by people before, and I was just like, what does this even mean? But I do think there's something to my background that plays into this, where I, like, you know, I come from humble beginnings, and I came into the world of business thinking it was one thing, and that, like, it took certain things to be successful. And so I think I, as like a younger Black creative, maybe felt less like I had permission to try some silly shit. And so hearing that I had permission to, like, you know, not hold the reins so tightly was super helpful for me.
Thank
you to people.
There's a number of things that I say. I think this is a really important slide. I'm glad you're talking about this, because I think all of us in advertising need to be reminded of this and given this explicit permission, because without even noticing it, we sort of naturally drift into
what's going to make people happy.
Overly responsible. What did the client want? Let's be reasonable here. You know, let's be creative, but let's be reasonable. And I think, especially as part of the creative process, we have to do the exact opposite of that. We have to go as far to the extremes as possible. And one of the things I like to tell creatives is bring me something I can't sell.
Yes, that's a great method.
And I especially say that if I've seen a round of work and I can just tell they're not even close to the edge. Like, I need them to get closer to the brink of insanity. And so I'll say, you know, bring me something I can't sell, or I'll say, you know, if it's possible and within budget, I'm not interested. Don't bring me anything that's possible. And what I'm doing there is I'm just trying to say, like, you have permission, not only permission, but I expect you to bring me totally unreasonable, unsellable ideas.
And it's not good for clients when creatives are being too responsible.
No,
it's so bad.
That's already, that job is already being done by many other people. That the job that needs to be done is to find where the edge is, to find where the cliff, how close to the cliff can you get before you fall off? And it's usually it's a lot further out than we think.
Yeah.
And so are there ways that you, as a creative director now, are there ways that you kind of give that permission to your creatives and encourage them to kind of push things and be less responsible?
I think a part of it is just hyping up the stuff that feels less responsible, because usually, or often, I won't say always, but often there's something in the deck that feels like a little bit of an outlier. And you're just like, okay, I could see that they, you know, there's some sauce on this that they may not have thrown into this other stuff. And to hype that stuff up and encourage it and ask and say, like, I want this to be so different from anything you've seen from this client before, helps. But I think that's one thing as a pretty new CD that I'm still trying to learn how to pull out of people. But I think a part of it is just encouraging them to do more of the stuff that is in that world when you see.
Yeah. And if there's creatives listening to this, or anybody listening to this, creative directors that are like, well, this isn't, don't, you know, you got to be, that's just not realistic. You know, bring me something I can't sell. You're going to have to, not everything's right for the client. Totally. It's definitely not. And that's the job of the creative directors and the account team, is to then like shape that, find the nuggets in there that you can shape into something that can be sold, or at least be attempted to be sold. But if you don't even go, if you don't even get those ideas, the interesting ideas are always going to be the ones that are pushing to some extreme. And you've got to first get those, that raw material to then work with. Nobody's saying, oh, we should only present irresponsible stuff to clients. Not at all. But you got to get that raw material. You got to get the really interesting stuff that's pushing it. And then that's not, the job of the creatives is not to make it responsible. That's the job of the creative director and the strategy, you know, the rest of the team. They should be free to just absolutely go for it. And there's plenty of other people that are going to provide the safety net, that are going to be responsible. They shouldn't be spending their time doing that, right?
No. It's so much easier to like take something that is interesting and make it sellable than it is to like make something sellable interesting.
Yeah, totally. It's way, absolutely. And when you, if you're not a creative director, you realize that when you become one, way easier to take a crazy, interesting idea, like you said, than it is to like take a boring idea. I mean, it's extremely difficult to take a completely uninsightful, boring idea and make it interesting. It's, in most cases, it's impossible. You just got to come up with a different idea.
It's just the smart thing to do though, too. Cause like, think about it. You are competing with the internet, with inflammatory news. You're like, you're competing with so much interesting stuff that's happening in the world. And so if you're coming super safe, like, good luck to you. Okay. Realizing that some of your favorite work was literally just giving the client what they wanted. And this took me a while to learn. Over time, I sort of noticed that usually it was so much easier to get something out the door in the way that I wanted it out the door when I just started at a place that accepted what the ask was or allowed the clients to just say, yes, okay, this is hitting all the boxes. There was, I think it was Eric Hallman, like gave a talk at, I don't know where I was, but he just literally reverse engineered, like showed, this is the work that was made for like Skittles and this is the brief. And it was, everything was so on brief. And I was just like, yo, like, wow, this is how you sold it. Like, this is answering the thing that's being asked. And yet it's still this really strange, like piece of work that you can't look away from. And after I heard that, it changed my mind about how to approach stuff quite a bit.
Yeah, this is huge. It's probably the number one question that I get from the people who take my program is like, how do you sell work? How do you sell work to clients? How do you get them to buy great work? And the one of the biggest things, one of the biggest unlocks is this, exactly what you're saying here. You got to start from understanding what is the ask, but even deeper than that, like what is this client? The more that you can listen, empathetically listen to the client and ask them questions. And this is mostly, you know, a creative director is the creative director and account team and strategy have more opportunity to do this than a creative does, but really interrogate the client and try to understand what's in their head. What are they dealing with? What does success look like for them? What's happening politically inside their organization? The more you can figure out what they need and what they want, and then you just got the roadmap or the combination to unlocking how to sell work to them. And if you can find a really creative way to do that and find that Venn diagram of like the circle of here's the stuff they want and need, and here's the crossover of things you want to make, and find out where those two can cross over so that it's still something really exciting to you. That was the biggest unlock on Old Spice, was just accepting that this is Procter & Gamble. They invented modern marketing, and there were certain things that they just were going to have. They're never going to want to buy anything that doesn't show their product, talk about their product. And the as soon as we embraced that and just said, oh, we're going to give them everything they want, but we're just going to do it in a crazy way, the work just instantly got easy to eat, much, much easier to sell.
That's so true. And I would say like interrogating actual needs or whatever, like if you are not a CD or an account person or a strategist, I would be the creative who was asking those people what was really going on, so that I did have that extra context. When I was younger, I felt like sometimes decisions would come back and things would die, and I wouldn't completely understand what was happening or why. And I think as I got a little bit older, I started to look a little bit closer, have more conversations about those things to actually understand. And I think when I went client side, like that really opened my head up, where I was like, oh, all right, I probably need to start being a little bit more empathetic to needs. Versus yeah. Like, this is the creative idea that I love and I want to make it, and you need to know, you know, that this is the right decision. But just a little empathy goes really far. So
yeah, I love what you're saying there, though. For if you are not a creative director yet, don't be afraid to go and like ask a ton of questions and be curious. And I just had Emma Barnett on the show, and she was talking about how annoying she is and how you got to be willing to be annoying and be willing to ask a lot of questions and be sort of relentless. And you might, as a creative, unlock this because the people, the CDs that you're selling the work to and the rest of the team that kind of needs to get on board with it, they probably know things that they didn't share, not out of ill will, they just maybe thought it wasn't relevant. And sometimes it can be helpful for you to know that so that you can get the internal team on board with your work as well. If you're enjoying this content and would like me to continue to do interviews like this, please take a moment right now to subscribe and hit the little notification bell so that you're notified when new episodes drop.
We'll get back to the podcast in just a moment, but if you want to listen to the full version of this episode and all other full episodes of Bagley Talks to an Important Person, which are usually a full hour longer, check out Creative Mega Machine, Jason's exclusive 8-week creative coaching and mentorship program, where Jason throws 6 metric tons of highly illegal, non-EPA approved rocket fuel on your career. Creative Mega Machine is a time machine for your career, teaching you exactly how to get the best work of your life about a decade earlier than you would otherwise. Through on-demand lessons and live Q&As with Jason, he will personally answer all your questions as he reveals all the secrets and techniques that he and his team's used to create iconic campaigns for Nike, Old Spice, KFC, Meow Wolf, and more. You will learn in 8 weeks what took him 16 years at Wieden and Kennedy to learn. There is absolutely nothing out there that will accelerate your creativity and earning potential faster than this 5-star rated program. Classes are capped at 20 students, so grab your spot before they're gone. Check out the show notes below to learn more about Creative Mega Machine. Let's get back to the podcast.
And then lastly, I hope this was useful to someone out there. Take what works and just leave what doesn't. Yeah, these are a few things that help me make work.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks for sharing that, Yukimi. Okay, so let's get into, you are a new creative director. When I compare myself, like that was something I never thought would happen. I was amazed that I was at Wieden & Kennedy in the first place. I definitely was 100% certain that I was never going to become a creative director at Wieden & Kennedy. So when it happened for me, it was a shock. It was like kind of amazing and obviously very intimidating. What was it like for you?
Yo, I was just like, eventually someday, but someday felt like very far away. I was like, I just got here. I'm just figuring stuff out. I don't think I'm ready for that. But I got invited to a pitch and we won the pitch. And then they asked if I wanted to work on the account. And CD, I was just like, what? Okay.
If you don't want to be a CD,
absolutely shocking.
If you don't want to be a CD, don't win a pitch. That's a definitely one of the back doors into becoming a CD. But yeah, so you were super shocked by it.
No, yeah, it was so unexpected. I was like, okay, yeah, we'll work on this a little bit, but I didn't expect them to ask us to be the CDs. But it was exciting, but it was also very nerve-wracking because I was like, wait a second. Like I'd been at Wyden I've been in the industry for a while, but like at Wyden about 2 years. So I was just like, have I been a creative here long enough? I don't know yet, but I'm going to give it a try and see what happens. And it is such a different job, Bagley. Like, you know this. You get good at something and then they go, oh, you're good at that. Come do this other thing. This is going to be great. And I was like, okay, it will, right? Okay. But no, there's parts of it that are like awesome. Like I love being able to be more of an advocate for the creatives and being in, you know, certain meetings and calls that I was not a part of before. I love having the ability to like help find new voices to hire. I like love the part of, you know, sitting with creatives and kind of figuring out how to make space for their best work to shine and go. It's mad different to suddenly not be the person writing things. And the first year I tried so hard not to like give in to that urge to like be directly impacting what was happening on the pages. And I feel like I've gotten a lot better at that now, but it was different because you just kind of don't feel like you're being as effective at first, where you're just like, what am I doing? I'm in these meetings, but I didn't write anything cool. so yeah, no, it's fun, but in a different way. And you do have to be open to working in another capacity, I guess.
Yeah. I loved Carl Lieberman's metaphor. He said, being a creative, and I don't know if he was just talking about being a creative at Wyden and Kennedy, but being a creative is like careening on the edge of a cliff in a car, driving at high speed. And being a creative director is being in the passenger seat in that same car, but you're not supposed to tell the driver how to drive. And being an executive creative director is you're in the trunk of that same car texting.
Oh man, yo, that's actually pretty accurate. You're not, you're just not touching the work in the same way. And you have to figure out what that means. And I got like, they did this thing called like Leadership Academy, and I was in the like pilot program for it the first year. So we got a little bit of training, but it's still so much is just learned doing the work and doing the job. But it's hard because you sometimes want to come in and go, this is the line that I think would solve it, or you know, I think this concept changed to be this, but you have to get comfortable just being more of a guide.
And how do you balance that trying to keep your hands off of it and let the creatives do the work themselves while still having to be the quality control? And your job is, as a creative director, is you have to set a high bar and you have to make sure the work reaches that bar.
Yeah.
But you're not supposed to do the work yourself. So how do you do that?
A part of it is trusting your people. Like, you know, listen, like, you know, they can pull it off. They have it in them. They're able to do it, but you have to be there to just point them in the right direction. If, you know, you see a batch of work and like some of it isn't working, like look at the stuff that is working and answer their questions and ask them questions about what they're actually doing or what they're attempting to do so that they find answers themselves. So it's less like I'm going to give you the answer and I'm going to, or versus I'm going to help you find your answer. And it might not even come to you in the way that you expect it to. And it, you know, I've been surprised a few times with the way that people solve stuff in a pleasant way.
So do you have any thoughts on what is a big creative platform? Because we get more and more creative directors are asked, like, don't come with a campaign. We need a big creative platform. And sometimes that's not very clearly defined what that is exactly. And even more so, like, how do you come up with that?
Yeah. That's a good question. You know what, Jason? I don't even know if I know the answer to this, but I'm going to try. So I feel like for me, a big creative platform is like it's like a base, a foundation for something, for an idea where you can go in a lot of different directions. Like, of course, yes, it could be TV, but it could also be like a way to show up on Twitter, or yes, okay, it could also be a way that we do out of home, or we could come up with a TV show that is based on this idea. We could like create, you know, merchandise and clothing that is based off of this idea. It's just, it's a foundation for an idea that has a lot of legs. Like it's, I don't know if that's the right answer, but that's where my head goes when.
Yeah. I think it's definitely not the wrong answer. Let's just say that.
It's an answer.
I mean, certainly that is a characteristic of a big creative platform idea, is that it's got to, you can go in a lot of different directions. If it can only be executed in film, then it's maybe a campaign, but it's not a big platform idea.
It also, sometimes it also has like a more longevity too. Like you can keep building off of it for a long time. Like you don't have to stop just because like a moment's passed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What advice would you give on presenting and selling work to clients?
I think those are two related but also separate questions.
Yeah.
For presenting, I think it's very important to like know your stuff, to like come with some excitement, like, oh my gosh, last year there was a team that shared some FIFA World Cup stuff, and the way that they did this presentation was chef's kiss, so good. Like you could feel their excitement. You got excited about it. There was face paint. I don't know why there was face paint, but I was excited it was there. And just, you know, and then the work was like able to like live up to the performance. So I think presenting, like for the person who's watching you present, they need to know that you're into what you're actually sharing. Like that's so important. And if you're not into it, like, why are you sharing it? It goes back to the don't show stuff that you're not excited about. And then for actually selling it in, I also think the passion thing is important, like, and persistence and tenacity and like making sure that you know what it is that the client is looking for or what they need to achieve or what's going on in their world that you can help out with so that the idea can just move through and not be blocked by stuff that you're not paying attention to or looking at. And that might be, you know, more of a thing for like accounting.
Yeah.
The CDs, but I think selling is so much of it is not just the idea. So much of it is like context and timing and empathy. So
yeah, and the most of the selling I think happens before the meeting, before the presentation.
Oh my gosh! Yes, like did we land on a brief that everybody actually agrees to? Yeah. That's massive. Like, are we solving the problem that actually needs to be solved?
And did we talk to the client enough? Do we understand them enough beforehand, which probably happened before the brief even happened, that we understand not only what the brief should be, but all the details and as much as we can about what does this client need? How do we create work that's going to be fantastic and that we're excited about making?
Yeah.
But that client can easily buy as well. Then that happens before. But going back to your advice about the enthusiasm and like bringing some passion. I think to some extent, like, we need to not be afraid to put on a show. Like, I think the clients, they want that. They want us to perform. They want to see, they've usually meeting with the agency is their most exciting part of the day. It's they want it to be fun. They want it to be engaging, and they want to see that you care about their brand and that you're enthusiastic about their brand and the work. And I think the thing that holds creatives back, probably, you want to hear what you say about this too, but it goes back to that fear of vulnerability. Getting up there and like putting on a show and painting your face or whatever happened at this World Cup presentation, you're putting yourself out there. You're making yourself vulnerable, as opposed to, all right, we open up in a cafe and like there's a, when we don't do that, we're kind of protecting ourselves. We're like, well, I'm not going to put myself out there, and so there's not going to be as much rejection if it doesn't go well. But you're dramatically increasing the chances that there is going to be rejection because you're not creating something that's exciting that people want to be a part of.
Yeah. And if they're like glazing over at the way that you're talking about your own idea, that's a problem. Like,
yeah,
there's so much in presentation. There's just, that's the first connection point for them to be exposed to the stuff that you've been working on. And like, I think if you sound like you're just not into it, they're not going to be into it either.
And how do you,
maybe that's a good trick for like the stuff that you don't want to sell through. lower the octaves.
So how do you do that? How do you get yourself in a position personally to put yourself out there in a presentation and be enthusiastic and really kind of put on that show? Obviously you do that because you talked about like you basically wrote a song and performed it on a video, but knowing that there is a chance you're going to do that and they're going to not like the idea at all, how do you mentally prepare for that or get yourself to a point where you're able to do that and recover when it still doesn't sell?
You got to be able to laugh about stuff, but it starts before you get into the room where you have to like what you're sharing. Like, if you don't like it, it's going to be hard for you to be okay with the rejection. But if you know something that you love is rejected, you're just like, okay, that's fine, but this is still good. I remember, I'm not going to name the client, but there was a point where I like wrote some radio and I had to like, I'm trying not to give too many details. I had to perform these voices. And it was a weird call, Bagley. Like, I was making very strange noises into a conference phone. And then there was just like silence at the end. And I was just like, okay, well, that was maybe one of the most awkward calls I've ever had, but I liked the spot. Like, it was an awesome spot. I loved it. I thought it was fun, and they eventually did actually buy it. So maybe the excitement on, you know, this end actually did something. But it just was like, it was a weird call where like, I didn't feel like my energy was matched. But that's okay. It doesn't always have to be.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. It is one of the reasons why you have to love what you're presenting. It's going to be very hard to fake that kind of enthusiasm. And then I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I kind of get myself into a state of like the possibility of crashing and burning is exciting, where I'm like, this could go horribly wrong. And if it does, that's going to be hilarious. or that's going to be exciting, or that's, I've already prepared myself that it's going to be okay, that it's going to either be funny or I'm going to have a great story to tell or whatever, but I'm going to do it. And I get myself, instead of going in like, oh my gosh, what if this doesn't go well? What if this is going to be awful if I get up there and like wave my hands around and dance around in the room and it doesn't go well? Oh, this is going to be terrible. I got to get myself in the opposite mindset where I'm like, hey, this will probably go great. But even if it doesn't, even if I absolutely crash and burn, that's still going to be awesome because I'm going to, that's going to be funny and I'm going to have a story to tell or whatever. Then I have nothing to lose. Then it's like, regardless of the outcome, this is going to be okay.
You got to tap into that like inner theater kid where, listen, say what you will about them, but they bring it. Like, listen, they might make you cry. They might make you laugh. They might make you cringe, but like they're still putting something out there. And I think you just have to embrace the discomfort a little bit sometimes.
Yeah. And also take pride in being somebody who goes for it. Like, hey, I may fall on my face half the time, but
I'm trying.
I'm somebody who goes for it. I go all in, and that you should take pride in that. And even when it doesn't work out, like that's awesome. You're that type of person that goes for it. So, all right. Well, Yakima, this has been awesome. I don't know if you have any other thing you want to talk about before we hang out, but it's been really fun to sit and talk with you and pull all the gems out of your brain for the creatives out there.
Hope it was helpful for them at least a little bit. Because, man, I feel like I could have used so much more. Like, I appreciate that you're doing this because I could have used so much guidance as a young creative and even before I was actually a creative. Like, I remember trying to become a copywriter and people kept telling me, oh, well, you got to go to portfolio school. I'm like, I already graduated. I don't want to go back to school. But I just didn't have anybody around me to like go to or to ask questions. Like I didn't know a single person who was actually in the industry. And I was like, you know, from a town that didn't have agencies. So it was all just starting from zero. So it's like awesome to see that now there's all this stuff happening to introduce people to things earlier and kind of try to get them on the right track without them just needing to always jump in and help for the best, which you're going to do that anyway, but to have a little bit of mapping is nice.
How did you get in if you didn't go to portfolio school? Because I didn't go to portfolio school either.
Oh, I did reluctantly. It was like, okay, I'll try to do the like truncated version of this story, but like I started way back in college. Like I went to college, I didn't have a major because I was sick of journalism. Like that's what I did in high school. And I was just like, I need to do something else with my life. And so I spent the first 2 years of college just like taking whatever classes and trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I took business classes. I found them very boring. I took like, you know, social science and psychology courses, but I was like, what, how do I apply this to a life? And then like in the back of my mind, I always thought like, oh, you know, it'd be nice to be a writer, but I don't know how to like actually make a living doing that. Like I've, you know, grown up pretty, I guess you could say poor, and I don't want to stay there. So eventually it was one summer where they like told me I had to pick a major to graduate and to become a junior officially, I had to have a major. So I was like, I don't know, here, I'm going to pick psychology for now and see. But that summer I also took a copywriting course and I was just like, wait, oh my gosh, it's the business, it's the psychology, it's the writing all in one thing. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be this. So I start attempting to build a portfolio. It's awful. Bagley, like it's so bad. It's terrible. I don't have an art director. Everything is just not good. Like there's an inkling of like, maybe she could pull this off one day. But that's what why people kept telling me, you got to go to portfolio school, after I graduated and was trying to get a job during a recession. And so I did end up going back, and I was like, if this doesn't work out, then I'm not supposed to be a copywriter, and I'll have to just move on to something else. But it worked out, and here we are.
Luckily, it did. Thankfully, it did, and we get to have Yakima in the industry and on Bagley Talks to an Important Person for everyone to enjoy.
How many, like, did you know that people would be really uncomfortable with the title?
Yes. I hoped they would be flattered and uncomfortable. That was it. And I just thought it was a funny title too. All right. Well, awesome. Thank you so much for being on. Thanks for taking the time. I know you're super busy. This is great. I'm sure it's going to help a lot of people. Are you an advertising creative or creative director, and despite all your hard work, you're still not making the kind of creative you want? Well, I know what it's like to be frustrated that you aren't getting better creative opportunities, feeling like you're falling behind your peers and not getting the support you need. Using a specific 7-step process, my teams and I have been able to win major advertising awards every year for 20 consecutive years. If you would like to learn the exact same 7-step process my teams and I use to create iconic campaigns for Old Spice, Nike, KFC, and others, and how you can start doing the best work of your life in less than 60 days, click the link somewhere on or around this video, and it'll take you to a page where you can register for a completely free online training I put together for any creatives wanting to do the best work of their life. So go ahead, click the link on or around this video and register for the free training, and I'll see you there.